A decade of dramatic changes in Maine, an encore presentation. On New Year's Eve in 2009, Maine had yet to emerge from recession. The unemployment rate was 8.2%. Since then, it has fallen 5 points. The state was different in many other ways, too. Same-sex marriage was not legal. Brunswick Naval Air Station had not formally closed. The minimum wage was $7.50 an hour. John Baldacci was governor, Paul LePage, mayor of Waterville. And Maine's craft brewing scene was pretty tiny, with only 28 licensed craft breweries. Now there are 153. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our show with Maine editorial page editors on the decade that was. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is amazing how much has happened in Maine this past decade. Today, we're going to talk about some of the biggest news stories, trends, and changes that have taken place in our state in the last 10 years. Joining me in the Portland studio, Ben Bragdon, who is editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, Greg Kessich, editorial page editor with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, is also here in the studio with me. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. And as always, we want to hear from you. What events or issues mattered most to you in this past decade? What changes affected your life? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I know all four of us have been journalists in Maine for this entire decade, if not much longer. And so it's going to be really interesting to hear all of your perspectives. And I'm just going to start with a little confession. I had to do some searching of dates when I was preparing for today's show. And one of the things I thought to myself, now, was the same-sex marriage referendum in this past decade? And indeed it was. It was 2012. And Ben, that just sort of got me thinking of, you know, that seems like so long ago, but really a reminder of what a different place Maine was New Year's Eve 2009.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't get a whole lot of chance to look back 10 years. It's not like, you know, when at the end of 2018, you look back to 2008 and reflect on the last 10 years. So I guess any 10-year period, there's a lot can happen. But, you know, when 10 years ago today, Maine was a much different place. You know, the old kind of economy of Maine, what we think of with the mills and factories, had taken a big hit by that point, and there would be some more hits to come. But that was a huge part of the state that was undergoing this huge change, and everyone at that point 10 years ago was kind of shocked by what was going on. It was affecting everything. It was affecting schools and you know, the number of kids they had and who could stay in the town they grew up in, and all those things were really starting to happen. Everyone was really angry about it at that point because the a lot of those parts of the state had really struggled for even the prior 10 years, but we were, you know, at the kind of peak of the big Great Recession that is really knocking out a lot of people who were, you know, just kind of teetering before. And everyone was kind of shocked about trying to figure out what was next for the state. Now, 10 years on, we're kind of starting to see what the next phase of, you know, the Maine economy and the Maine way of life in the rural areas and the cities, what that's going to look like.
That's right. Susan, you know, looked it up. This time, 10 years ago, unemployment rate 8.2%. The recession hit Maine hard.
Yeah, it did. And we're still, you know, took us a long time to dig out from the recession as well. And a lot of the country was doing better more quickly than Maine was. Ben mentioned the closure of the paper mills. I don't think, you know, in 2010, we would have expected that so many mills would no longer be operational. I mean, it's just kind of a sea change in the Maine economy. I also look at it as an interesting decade of contradictions. Politically, we elected conservative governor, Republican control of the state house briefly. But at the same time, Maine voters supported some really progressive initiatives, like you mentioned, same-sex marriage. That was approved at the ballot box. Voters approved the state increase in the state's minimum wage, legalized marijuana, more recently approved death with dignity. So we saw Medicaid expansion. We saw a lot of progressive policies at the same time that Maine people were electing some conservative folks to lead the state. So it was interesting to watch those two different tracks not always smoothly interact, but made for a lot of interesting political discussion over the last decade, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting, Susan, the dichotomy there. You're right, the progressive, so many progressive agenda items sort of just checked off. And you mentioned death with dignity. When that had been a ballot question, that was a huge statewide issue, and it went down in a very close vote, but it was almost uneventful last year in the legislature when death with dignity was passed. Greg, when you think about the decade, what are you thinking about?
Well, I think it's we entered this era of government by referendum, and we've had a lot of referendums in recent years, but I think there was a dozen citizen-initiated laws that went to the voters in this last 10 years, and they weren't just small things. Many of them were the things that Susan listed off: marriage equality, a really very broad structural change to the minimum wage, where there was $1 increases a year for I think 4 years, and now we're going to there'll be one tomorrow, and then we go into a period where it's tied to inflation and continues to increase. And that's shown up in poverty numbers. It's shown up in overall wages statewide. So that it was a huge event. And it's the kind of thing that could never have passed through the legislature the way it was constituted, especially during the last 6 years of the LePage term, where the Democrats had one house, the Republicans had another house, and the governor was vetoing everything he didn't like and had enough backing in the House to block two-thirds override votes. So, one of the outcomes of that has been these big, very bold changes. Another has been a lack of compromise, because when you go to referendum, you don't compromise. And, when you're dealing with Paul LePage, he doesn't compromise. So that's that's sort of the legacy of this last decade.
You know, you mentioned the minimum wage. 10 years ago, the minimum wage in Maine was $7.50, and tomorrow it will be $12. You say it's reflected in the poverty rates. What are we seeing? What is the economic impact that we can measure so far?
You can track families in poverty and children in poverty. You can see changes in the numbers that coincide with increases in the minimum wage.
And are the numbers going down?
I can't say that they're all going down. I think you have to compare them to the national numbers, but mm-hmm. They correlate favorably to the national numbers.
All right.
I didn't know there was going to be any math.
I'm sorry.
on this. I thought 10 years, that's a number I could relate to.
Susan, of course, we've all mentioned Governor LePage, and of course, a huge part of this last 10 years. He was governor for 8 years of the last decade. And we've said it before, but Ben, I'm going to bring it up again. Paul LePage foreshadowed the national political scene. What we had happen here in Maine,
yeah,
as Maine goes, or as Maine went.
Yeah, certainly he, like Greg said, governed in this time and really took advantage of the kind of hardening of the sides of partisanship and the inability they don't want to compromise. Not so much the inability to, but there's really no one to get it. But, I always say, like, Donald Trump, there's only one story in Washington, D.C. right now, and that's Donald Trump. And there's just a million iterations of that same story. But they all get back to his governing style, his approach to the office, his own personality. And we had that with Paul LePage before. There was really only one political story for those 8 years he was in office. And even from the time, a little time before and a little time after, And that story was Paul LePage. He, you know, he came to office in the surprise win at a time, I think, that, you know, he really kind of redefined what the problems were in Maine. And I remember being in Piscataquis County in the decade before and hearing a lot of this stuff from people, people that were, you know, looking at the state and trying to decide, trying to discern what was wrong with it. And I think Paul LePage came in and really, at a time when the rural parts of the state were changing and the economy was really hurting, gave somebody to blame about it. And he said, you know, the problems with this state are that the welfare is too generous and taxes are too high and regulations are too onerous. And it really got back to something people wanted to hear at that time. And the President Trump has kind of continued that same thing at the national level. It's like it's a way to you know, we always said Paul LePage had a pretty high ceiling as far as support, but also a low floor. You know, he had that like 40% of Mainers, and we say the same thing about Donald Trump now. And the question is, you know, Paul LePage showed the kind of limits to that sort of support. He really couldn't do a lot. He could stop a lot, but he couldn't, you know, get a lot done. And we're kind of seeing that sort of start to manifest itself on the national level.
Susan, as you and other reporters of Bangor Daily News look back at the LePage legacy, what are your thoughts here on the eve of 2020?
I mean, two things. He certainly changed politics in Maine. I mean, I think if you've 10 years ago asked people if a governor would tell the NAACP to kiss his butt or say things about Drew Gittin that I can't even repeat on the radio, I mean, people would have been shocked that our politics would have gotten so coarse, so personal, with no accountability. I mean, he said things that were just unbelievable, and you know, the insulting, the hatred, the just making up facts, his buffalo and black fly studies, things that just weren't true. And there was a feeling that there were no consequences. You know, he was reelected fairly easily in 2014, so he certainly changed the tone and the way people politic, and also changed the way governors govern in Maine. Again, few consequences for his battles with the legislature, his refusal to do what the law required him to do, vetoed more bills than all the governors in Maine's history combined. It was just a totally different way of doing business that completely befuddled Democrats. They were struggled throughout his tenure to figure out how to respond to him, how to work with him. There were times that he compromised and worked with folks who he disagreed with, but often just said, no, I'm not going to do it. And what, you know, what are the avenues when you have a governor that does that? Do you take him to court? You know, the law says what you have to do, but I think the framers of Maine Constitution just assumed that a governor and lawmakers would follow the law. So they didn't write penalties in to the laws because it didn't occur to people that you'd have a governor who just didn't do what he was required to do. So it was just, you know, from a journalistic perspective, really interesting to cover. But it left a lot of Maine people behind. His changes at DHHS, you know, made a lot of families suffer, I believe, unnecessarily by taking away benefits, making it much harder to get the temporary assistance that they needed. He will never know how much business didn't come to Maine because of his attitude, his bad mouthing of the state, his refusal to support renewable energies and other types of businesses he didn't like. And I think there were a lot of damaging things that we won't know for a long time what his 8 years in office cost the state of Maine.
Greg Kessich, thoughts about the LePage legacy?
Well, I agree with everything that Susan just said. You know, the kiss my butt moment seemed really significant to me when I look back on the whole era, because it happened about a week, I think, or 2 weeks after he was inaugurated, during, you know, was supposed to be the honeymoon period, and we hadn't had a Republican governor with a Republican legislature in a long, long time. And there was some excitement about that. Like, you know, they were finally going to be driving the bus and you know, what, you know, they have a chance to see if their ideas would work. And it was Martin Luther King weekend. He was asked why he refused to go to the NAACP Martin Luther King Day breakfast. He said there are special interests, and I'm not going to be held hostage by special interests. It's a breakfast, you know. It wasn't they weren't like trying to get him to sign a bill or something. It was just a matter, you know. And it was a moment where he could have been magnanimous. He had just won this election. He was just inaugurated governor. He had a chance to just kind of reach out and say, you know, we're all in this together. This is one state. I know you didn't, you know, you probably, many of your members didn't support me, but let's all work, you know, let's all work together. And, you know, these things last as long as they last. But to just come out with, tell them they can kiss my butt, and then I've got a black son, and that makes me incapable of, you know, being insensitive on race, just you know, threw a wedge in between a lot of people who would have been able to work together, and it became set the template for the next 8 years. There was a period, 2 year period, where Republicans had control of both houses of the legislature, and they pushed through a number of big reforms: a big health care reform, a pension reform, and a big tax cut. And I think any Republican governor in that situation would have passed those three bills. But what's more telling was what happened afterwards. They immediately lost a majority in the actually first both houses and then just the House, and he just became a veto machine. That same kind of mean-spirited action, you know, approach to things that Susan was talking about, really, you know, lost a lot of opportunities to do things differently. One last point on the, you know, we talked about Medicaid expansion was vetoed. I can't remember how many times. Anybody remember?
Six
it was like
seven,
eight times,
yeah,
seven,
yeah,
eight
yeah,
times.
Yeah.
And a couple of the times it was came in the form put forward by Roger Cates and Tom Saviello, two Republican senators. And they had it was expansion plus turning Medicaid into a managed care program. And this was like a classic old-time legislative gambit where you, you let the other side get a win, but you advance one of your own priorities at the same time, and you can bring people together on a compromise. And he would have none of it. And he vetoed the bill and made his House members vote against it, and that was it. You know, and you know that's really the LePage era for me.
We're looking back at the last decade in Maine news. We'd love to have you join the conversation. 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page. So much we haven't even touched on yet. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud supporters of the voices of independent and in-depth journalism at Maine Public News.
It's easy to look back and remember the heavy news you heard in 2019. But what about the lighter stories from this past year? Like the story of this soul line dancing group in Washington, D.C., who dance for fitness and for community.
I love the people. I love the exercise. It's good for your brain. And it's still so much fun.
Or this group of Chicago churches who paid off the medical bills of thousands of local residents.
We hope it will have a ripple effect. And people who have been the beneficiaries of these gifts from us will then turn around and be a giver to someone else.
I'm Corva Coleman from NPR News. 2019 may almost be over, but there's still time for a little more good. When you support this station right now, you'll help us to continue reporting the news throughout 2020 and beyond.
Make your year-end donation today at mainepublic.org.
Many greetings. I'm Andris Nelsons. I'm thrilled to be conducting the Vienna Philharmonic for New Year's Day 2020. We have a wonderful program for you, some Beethoven to celebrate his 250th anniversary, as well as the wonderful music from the Strauss family. Please join me, Anders Nelsons, this New Year's Day from Vienna 2020 from NPR Music.
And that's tomorrow morning at 11 here on Maine Public Radio and also on Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the top news stories and trends of the decade here in Maine. Our panel of editorial page editors is here. Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Susan Young, we haven't really talked about probably, in my view, the biggest unfolding story of this last decade, a really sad one, which is the opioid epidemic. In 2017, a person died every day, and the years before and since haven't been much better.
Yeah, I mean, the little bit of good news is maybe the number of deaths are declining, but still a horrible, horrible problem that Maine and other states are struggling to get a hold of. No one's found the solution to really turn the tide on the epidemic. We know so many things that work, medication-assisted treatment, counseling services, but still just such a struggle. Started with painkillers, we're a state where a lot of people work with, do a lot of physical heavy labor, so a lot of people struggling with pain. So we had a lot of prescriptions for opioid painkillers. Folks got addicted and then started abusing or turned to illegal sources. And then also, the heroin epidemic. It's just tragic and frustrating. Janet Mills has made it a priority, but lots of folks have spent a lot of time looking at very hard at this and trying to find ways. There are some success stories here in Bangor, groups that are doing good work, but it's just not on a scale to really take a bite out of the problem. And the tragedy is, the ongoing trauma that families and particularly children face, growing up in families where substance abuse disorder is such a big problem. It's something, unfortunately, the state is going to grapple with for a long time, hurting our people and costing a lot of taxpayer dollars to try and get a handle on improving life for these folks.
Right. And so many so much of a ripple effect. And you mentioned the children, more children in foster care, a burden on Maine's health care system. Greg, relating it back, finally Maine has Medicaid expansion. Does this help curb the opioid epidemic?
We use terms like epidemic and disease. They're accurate. It acts like an epidemic. It spreads if you don't kind of contain the illness, it spreads to other people. And to the extent that people are in treatment, and especially if they're in medication-assisted treatment and they are not buying street drugs and creating a market for people to push drugs, maybe that means new people will be exposed and the epidemic won't grow. But I think in many cases, you're talking about a lifelong condition that people will struggle for as long as they're alive. And even the most successful people are in danger of relapse. And we've seen cases of people who are actually out helping other people, people who had sort of seemed to have overcome their addiction and were doing good things with others who relapsed and overdosed. So it's just a terrible, terrible problem, and it will be with us for a long time. And I think we can the best we can do is try to contain in the epidemic.
And Ben, this is in your coverage area, mm-hmm. probably the deepest part of the story, the deepest part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, you saw where the opioid epidemic took hold around the country in the old Rust Belt and areas that very much resembled northern and western Maine, And, you know, we and like Susan said, we, you know, we really should have seen this coming. We had the OxyContin problem starting in the late 90s. We had all the pharmacy robberies at the turn of the decade. I looked it up. There was almost 60 in 2012. I remember being a local reporter at that time, and it seemed like there was like every day there was one. And then they stopped. And but they stopped because we started getting cheap heroin and people weren't going for the pills anymore. And unfortunately, we spent a lot of time arguing over whether these people deserve treatment or not. And, you know, you can remember one of the Governor LePage's first action. He ended up pulling back reimbursements for methadone treatment. He didn't like methadone. So we were cutting back the resources that we didn't really have enough resources. We were cutting them back at that time. And we spent all this time without a state response to it because Governor LePage didn't want to, and the legislature couldn't get anything through him. And it took us a long time to get moving in the right direction. There were, you know, the hospital networks and treatment centers and all these other individuals and organizations were doing stuff. But like Susan and Greg said, it wasn't happening on the scale that we needed. It kind of feels like we're getting there, but it's a huge, huge problem. And those people are going to be dealing with it for the rest of their lives. And we just got to make sure that we have the system set up to help them.
We're talking about the Decade in Review in Maine News. The phone number for your part of the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to go to a message here from Lucy, and then she says, just for context, 10 years ago, most people didn't have smartphones. Shows us how fast technology and our forms of communication have evolved. Some other big cultural shifts that we've seen. We've seen this state become known for having so many young farmers. We've seen a state that's known for its food scene, and Greg, known for its craft brewery explosion. I mean, there are something like we've gone from 28 to 153 licensed breweries in 10 years.
You know, I've been around Maine for more than 10 years, and I've been to a lot of economic development you know, briefings and plan, seen a lot of plans. I never heard anybody say, you know, what Portland needs, about 200 more restaurants, you know, really expensive ones. And
some hotels.
And some hotels. And it turns out, guess what? People come here to stay in a hotel and eat food. You know, this is something that, like, nobody was, it wasn't in anybody's plan, but it's become, you know, millions of dollars in economic development. And the same is true with the craft brew industry. It used to be there were a couple of, you know, main brewers, and there were a number of, like, you know, practically hobbyists, a little, maybe a step beyond hobbyists. And now it is a viable way to start a business and make a living. And there is a market for beer that's made here, and people come here to drink it, and they bring it home with them, and they, you know, they export it. And so it's fascinating. I mean, we, I think we could have seen the what was happening to the paper industry coming. You know, people's habits were changing. People were using less paper. They were, you know, the kind of publications that we produced the glossy paper for here were having their circulation was shrinking. But I don't think anybody saw the opportunities that would arise from things like food and beer and you know, or small scale farming.
Sure. And, you know, Maine has always been known, or for a long time been known, as vacation land. But Susan, now we're seeing, you know, tourism like we have never seen before. The big story out of Acadia National Park the last 2 years, what to do with all the cars, where to put everybody who's coming to Maine.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue that lots of national parks are dealing with across the country, as traffic into the parks. I mean, Yosemite, I'd love to go sometime, but I've heard it's a nightmare, you know, trying to get anywhere because the traffic is so bad. So I guess maybe it's a good problem to have. You know, as those user numbers go up every year, Acadia gets busier and busier. And as you mentioned earlier, we have a new national monument with hopes of bringing people to the interior of Maine, Katahdin Woods and Waters, created through Roxanne Quimby, who was controversial for most of this decade, and her son, Lucas St. Clair, donating the land to the federal government. And, you know, now we have a national monument near Baxter State Park. the visitorship numbers are higher than expected. You know, still small. It's going to take time, but you talk to people who live in Millinocket, in Patton, Island Falls, communities around the monument, already seeing an increase in tourism. You know, some spiffed up hotels, new dining and overnight accommodation options, services catering to people that are biking and hiking in the area. So hopefully that will draw more visitors to the interior of Maine, where, you know, we'd love to have just a proportion of the folks that come to visit the coast every year.
I'm so glad you brought up Katahdin Woods and Waters, Susan. We can't talk about a decade in Maine news without talking about that. I'm going to read an email from Paul. An observation, LePage's legacy might even include ranked choice voting. Oh. Mm-hmm. Were it not for his plurality wins, the People's Initiative might not have succeeded. It's ironic that it was found partially unconstitutional. It will be an interesting issue to watch for the next decade. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really came out of it. You saw ranked choice voting start as a kind of nonpartisan idea that was kind of outside of the system. And then it quickly became partisan after the 2010 election when Democrats thought they should have won, and or at least had a – or they were going to have trouble – the way that they were going to lose a statewide race was having a three-way – three- or four-way race with three kind of more left-leaning people against one conservative. And that's what happened in 2010, and that's kind of – it's interesting. I think 2010 was this big win for Republicans, but looking back at it now, I think they see the kind of the vulnerability they're in, because you know, people have tried to take on the Paul LePage mantle and haven't been able to do it. And so while he was able to win a couple of statewide races, it didn't seem like it was really transferable to anybody else. Like, it was just Paul LePage who could pull that off. And so I think you saw a lot of Republicans looking around and saying, I don't know, we're having real trouble on a statewide race. And you saw it with the referendums, too. They didn't want things going to referendum because on statewide issue, they were going to have trouble winning. But they could, through the legislative process, kind of stop some of the things that they didn't want, even if they didn't always have a majority. So those two things, the referendum and the ranked choice voting, were both came out of Paul LePage, and I think the writer is right that's kind of going to be how this is looked at going forward.
We'll go to Suzanne, who's calling from Nobleboro. Hi, Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. The thing that really has bothered me, I'm Franco-American. And I think Paul LePage brought disgrace and humiliation to the Franco-American community with his crudeness and his cruelty. And then he appointed Mary Mayhew, whom I call Mary Mayhem. And under their watch, two little girls died here in Maine as part of this legacy that he leaves behind.
Yeah, Susan, this is something the Bangor all the papers covered extensively, but you all especially. The deaths of the children in foster care.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so tragic. And as is often the case in these situations, there were warning signs. You know, calls were made to the Department of Health and Human Services. Not sure what kind of follow-up, but obviously it was inadequate, especially in the case of Marissa Kennedy. A lot of people raised red flags and said this family needs help, and they didn't get it. I mean, I don't know that we can lay the blame entirely Governor LePage's feet for that, but we know, you know, cutbacks within the department, constant reorganization, and demoralization of the folks that worked for the department certainly contributed to a lot of problems. Calls to a child abuse hotline went unanswered. There were just a lot of things that went wrong within the department. You know, since then, been several different groups reviewing what happened and making recommendations on how to improve the system, which some are already being put in place. So hopefully the department will be more robust and better able to cope with situations like that, because unfortunately, child abuse is just too rampant in Maine. It goes hand in hand with poverty and kind of the situations of despair. So hopefully the department is better equipped, but we all need to be vigilant and continue to make those kinds of reports. Hopefully they will be acted upon to try to ensure that these kind of situations don't happen again.
Suzanne, thank you so much for calling today's program. We're going to move to Jean in New Sharon. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling remembering the September report nationwide, actually, but it certainly impacts Maine, that birds were declining significantly. And we in Maine, in general, keep our image of a place where we're respectful of environment and treasure and hope to preserve it for future generations and hope we can keep intact forests and intact habitat for animals, especially birds that are vulnerable as they seem to be, because I've noticed a decline in our feeder over 30 years. And I hope that we can find a way not to have that continue.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling, Jean. Yeah, an example of a worldwide story with a very large impact here in Maine.
You know, I think it's related to climate change, which there were a number of ways that people in Maine became aware that the climate was changing. The water off Maine are not only getting warmer, but they're changing chemically. It's affected their fisheries. It's affected, you know, people who make a living close to the natural environment can see the changes that are happening. It's happening in the forests, and it's not a faraway story anymore.
Yeah, and it also shows that, you know, we depend so much on the environment here, on the water, on the woods, and a lot of that's out of our control. You know, Maine can do a lot. Should do its part to take on climate change, but we can't change anything on our own. And as the temperatures keep changing and our fisheries change and the number of too hot days in the summer changes and the amount of snow we get changes and the amount of bugs and other problems in the woods where people like to go to hike, as those come on in the next 10, 20 years, it's going to have a huge effect on Maine. And really the only way we can affect it is through, you know, nationwide and worldwide change.
Jean, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. What are you thinking about here at the very end of the decade? 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from BCM Environmental and Land Law, announcing a merger with Thomas R. Hanna and Associates. More on their Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine practice at nhlandlaw.com. Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Salt Pump Climbing, dedicated to providing indoor rock climbing at its finest. Learn more at saltpumpclimbing.com.
Let's face it, 2019 has been a tough year, so don't you think you could use a good laugh? Well, the Capitol Steps could not agree more. So tune in to the Capitol Steps New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. What better time to laugh at the state of our democracy than now, with elections right around the corner?
76 unknowns are the candidates.
Listen as President Trump gives an impassioned defense of his actions.
No president has ever been treated as badly as me. I know that's what you're all thinking. And that list includes James A. Garfield, William McKinley, and Abraham Lincoln. I did nothing in Ukraine. Just ignore the left.
The Capitol Steps won't tell you any actual useful information, but they will tell you what rhymes with Pete Buttigieg. So tune into the Capitol Steps, New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday, on this public radio station.
And that's this evening at 7 and tomorrow afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
There are many ways to be a leader. Some run big companies. Some serve on the school board or volunteer for causes they care about. Most leaders are regular people who want to make a difference. They do it by supporting what matters to them. I'm Tamara Keith. When you give to public radio, you're supporting reliable journalism. So please, follow your heart and be a leader. Make a year-end gift now.
You can make your year-end donation today at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're looking back at the past decade in Maine. Our panelists today, all editorial page editors, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Courtney calling from Belfast. Hi, Courtney. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. The thing that strikes me of importance in Maine is dam removal. I'm thinking specifically of the Vesey Dam and the Great Works Dam. I think this is an example of Maine's attention to the environment and to ecological restoration. Also around that issue were issues of Native American rights being addressed and still a bit contentious. And within that context, I want to talk about the growth of the land conservation movement in Maine. Many local communities have land conservation trusts or organizations, and with the leadership of Maine Coast Heritage Trust and other large organizations, this has been a really important conservation initiative in Maine that has grown, I think, a lot over the last 10 years.
Yeah, Courtney, all very good points. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Susan, Courtney mentions the addressing Native rights. And of course, a huge part of the story in the last few years was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which brought forth these just horrific stories that so many people were not aware of how Wabanaki children have been treated in this past century.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a national story of shame of how our government, both the state government and national government, has treated America's Native population. But there's some real positives, I think. You know, there was concern what the tribal relationship would be with Governor Mills, since she was Attorney General when the tribes were advocating for more rights over water quality. They wanted to have higher standards, and long term, the state had aligned more with paper companies than the tribes, and that was a very contentious battle with the tribes against Governor Mills. But she's done a lot with the first time having a tribal liaison in her office with Donna Loring. The Maine Indian Tribal State Commission is back up and running, giving the state a forum for discussion of tribal issues. We outlawed, unfortunately, we had to take that step, tribal names and mascots for schools. Skowhegan, the last high school to finally give up the Indian name. So a lot of progress in terms of state tribal relations, obviously a long way to go, but hopefully a better tone has been set. And I just wanted to quickly, we've talked about a lot of kind of dreary, heavy subjects, mention quickly some things that I think we need to be positive about. You know, Maine elected its first female governor with Janet Mills in 2018. I mean, it was really encouraging to see, especially in southern Maine, Maine's openness to new Mainers. When asylum seekers suddenly showed up in Portland, the community rallied, finding homes for these new arrivals, people donating clothes and cleaning supplies, and, you know, just really welcoming community. And, you know, we shouldn't forget New England dominated sports in the last decade. We had six national championships from the professional teams in Boston. So there were a lot of things to be positive about as well as we look back at the past decade.
Unless you're a Yankee fan, and then it's
well, then you shouldn't be. Then you're not welcome in the studio, Greg.
It's been kind of disappointing.
Ben, but I'm so glad you brought that up, Susan. Governor Janet Mills. There are people who, for years, have wondered if a woman could be elected governor in Maine, and you know, we all love what Governor Mills said when she said she was the first governor ever elected from Franklin County.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird that I don't know what it says that we can still make that news in you know, 2018. But I think, you know, the governor is right to quickly, you know, kind of shove that out. It's a big deal because it had never happened before. And it's strange to look back on history and have something like that happen. And there are other states that have never had a female. We of course had very prominent female members of the congressional.
Yeah, U.S. you know, Senate, Speaker right. of the House, yeah. all sorts of yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Greg, we had a big change in Portland's politics yes. in the last decade.
Yes, in the last 2 months. We also have our first woman mayor of popularly elected. Yes, Portland has adopted a popularly elected mayor system. In the first election was 2011, so that's in our decade, right? And it's a kind of a jury's still out about whether it was a good change. I was a big supporter of going to the system because I thought it would create, you know, an environment for somebody to run citywide and be kind of a, you know, a conduit for a number of issues and help set priorities. The problems have arisen about how much power the elected mayor has and how it's shared with the city manager and with the also elected city council. And the first two mayors have run into, trying different techniques have run into the same problems. We have a new mayor, Kate Snyder, who has run on a promise of working with the councilors and the manager, not against them, to put together a list of priorities for the city that the majority of people could get behind and act as kind of a facilitator rather than, you know, a my way or the highway type person. And we'll see. It, you know, that seems to be how the charter envisions the position. You know, we'll see if she's able to do it.
We'll go to John, who's calling from St. Albans. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to give former Governor Paul LePage some credit when he referred to the Katahdin Woods and Waters as a mosquito-infested right. wasteland, and that prompted my wife and I to go there. We got to go see this wasteland. And clearly he hadn't ever really been there. It is absolutely magnificent. And the east branch of the Penobscot, I always wondered why nobody whitewater rafted down that, and now I know. They would die.
I mean, talk about a great story of this past decade, the greater the Millinocket and the greater Katahdin region, that looked like a kind of dead area 10 years ago, a lost area. Everyone who had kind of wanted to do something else had left. The people that were left behind were kind of, a lot of them were looking backward and trying to get, you know, they were remembering the glory days of the paper mill and they wanted to get back there. But they really come together, this region, and kind of created, you know, that city was made out of nothing to be a paper city. And now it's kind of being remade, again, into something that's completely different. They have that winter marathon. They have all this outdoor opportunities. There's just a lot of like momentum in that area, and a lot of enthusiasm that really could shift to other places in the state.
A lot of the leadership for that came from the people who had left, who continued to stay involved. People who had, you know, successful careers in other parts of the country, but were able to kind of, you know, draw on the skills and the contacts that they had to you know, encourage growth in their own old hometown.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling. And speaking of areas that have seen a resurgence is, you know, one thing I learned this year is the youngest city in Maine today is Biddeford. Mm. And I think a big part of that is because the greater Portland area has become expensive and more young people are making other communities that are, you know, throughout the state revitalized. Auburn also becoming a much younger city than it was before. I want to quickly go to Mary on Facebook. She says, says, I can almost see all your heads nodding in unison about LePage. I'm a lifelong registered Democrat and still cringe when I hear Governor LePage described as our own President Trump. His background alone should bring those comparisons to a screeching halt, despite his superficial crudeness. His policy initiatives were a far cry from those of this incomprehensible, unstable president. And don't you think it was Cutler who led to this foolish introduction of RCV? So Mary doesn't like ranked choice voting. Governor LePage likes to say that he was Trump before Trump. So the he's brought the analogy on himself. But yeah. was it Cutler who brought on ranked choice voting?
Well, I don't know. I mean, his presence in that race certainly did. But also, if that first election, if that 2010 election had been a week later, we probably would have been talking about Governor Cutler. So, ranked choice voting was a response to some problems with these multiple candidate races. So.
All right. Well, Mary, thanks for that comment. And we'll go to Terry, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Terry. We're almost out of time. So if you could be quick, that'd be great.
I will be very quick. I just called to say how fortunate we are in Maine at the end of yet another decade to have such excellent print journalism, excellent reporters, photographers,
thank you.
And NPR
thanks, Mom.
Reporting.
That's true.
So many news sources around the country are folding. We are so fortunate. Yeah. And that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's true. Maine, yes. Maine has some very strong local journalism, and it really helps our state.
Yeah. Terry, thanks so much for that call. And, it's worth noting that is not usual in states around America today. We have major metropolitan areas with one paper, and we have states with very few daily papers. Greg?
Yeah. I mean, cities with much bigger population than the whole state of Maine that have one paper. The number of cities that have no paper is growing all the time.
Or a paper in name only.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think we have more magazines about Maine than ever before.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have, we talk about the regular daily newspapers, but Maine Biz is a very strong business publication, a newspaper. We, of course, have Down East Magazine and Maine Magazine and all the different iterations, Maine Women's Magazine. So
right. We're doing our part. In terms of the paper mills, I don't know what the Sears catalog isn't what it once was.
But. Well, thank you all so much for coming in and sharing your insights, not only today, but throughout the year. Greg Kesich is editorial page editor with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Happy New Year and Happy New Decade.